I'm going to law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is a 6'9 swingman. He can shoot the three.
Oh, this is so contrived.
I mean, is America, isn't it?
Hello, and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Friday, March 6, 2009. I'm Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer for Alligator Sports. And with me today are...
Evan Drexler, sports editor and football beat writer.
Kyle Maestri, baseball beat writer.
Mike McCall, football beat writer and columnist.
Mike DiPerdinando, basketball beat writer.
Bobby Colovey, baseball beat writer.
All right, before we get started today, I'm going to throw it to Evan to plug a little bracket challenge we're doing on our website. Evan, tell the listeners what it's all about.
Well, basically, you just go to the Alligator Sports website, and you click above the poll question, where we also have our daily poll question, to the link to our bracket challenge. And what you're going to do is you're going to fill out a bracket for the NCAA men's basketball tournament, like everyone loves to do so much. And you're going to be competing against the Alligator columnist and basketball beat writer. And if you have a better bracket at the end of the tournament than we do, then you get some nice prizes. Just go to the website and fill that out. And also, there is very slim chance for $100 million if you get a perfect bracket. That's also worth giving it a shot, but good luck with that one. You're going to need it. So just go to alligator.org/sports and click on the little link. You know, you'll see the banner ad. It says $100 million on it, so click that. Sign up, and after Selection Sunday, you can fill out your brackets.
I'll click anything with promise of $100 million on it.
There you go.
All right, and that's up right now, so you can start that now and go ahead and get your entry in before Selection Sunday. All right, with that, we're going to talk about a couple different things on today's show. We're going to start off with a little proposed BCF playoff system by the Mountain West Conference. From there, we're going to move into a little talk about the men's basketball team, a little bit of talk about the baseball team, and then wrap it up. So let's start it off. McCall, tell me about this BCS playoff reform proposed by the Mountain West.
Okay, yeah, this week, the Mountain West Conference, that's the conference that has Air Force, BYU, Colorado State, New Mexico, San Diego State, TCU, UNLV, Utah, and Wyoming. They have proposed a change to the BCS, the way the BCS works. It'll be an 8-team playoff if they get their way, but there will be 5 BCS bowls. So 10 teams will actually be a part of the BCS, but only 8 of them will actually be in the playoff. It does away with the computer system altogether. You don't have that anymore. You have a 12-person panel, which is one from each of the 11 conferences in Division 1A, and then one representative from Notre Dame. We'll get to that later because that's ridiculous. And those people will rank at the end of the year. They'll rank the top 25. The top 10 teams will get in the BCS. It preserves bowl tie-ins, meaning that, like, it, in any case where it's necessary, if an SEC champion is in the BCS, then they would still have a tie to the Sugar Bowl, and they would put them there. And then, you know, same with the other conferences. And then for the remaining teams that don't have a tie-in, the committee will sit down and schedule the games in there, you know, wherever they go. And then as far as venues go, this is a big deal also. They want to have the 4 current BCS games as the quarterfinals, as the first round games of it. And then progressing into later ones, they'll give the cities that host those games, Miami, New Orleans, you know, Pasadena and Glendale, they'll all have a choice whether they want to take a semifinal game and a final also. They'll probably be submitting bids and whatnot to get that. So let's get into this and see what everybody thinks of it. I'm assuming everyone's okay with them doing away with the computer system.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So
I actually don't like the fact that they're having 12 individuals vote on the rankings, because I think a lot of times it's just going to turn into a big political thing. The small conferences are going to try to squeeze the small conference schools like above in their polls. Big conferences are going to try to keep the big conferences. And the fact that Notre Dame has a vote equal to an entire other conference is unbelievable. Like, only in college football.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous that Notre Dame's been able to, like, play their own way this long. I mean, I think part of this proposal should be, this is really heavy on conferences. Like here's part of the thing that I think is really interesting. They have what's called an automatic qualifier conference, which means that the champion of that conference would automatically qualify for a BCS game if that there are 6 teams right now who they would classify as automatic qualifier conferences, because in the last 2 years, they have a minimum winning percentage of 400 against other conferences. And those 6 teams right now are the Mountain West, of course.
6 conferences?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, ACC, okay. Big Ten, Pac-10, Big East, Big 12, and SEC. So actually 7, but it says 6 in here. But anyway.
poorly written proposal.
Those teams or those conferences would have an automatic bid as long as they keep their winning percentage above 400. And for another conference to jump up into that group, they would have to play games against those automatic qualifier conferences and have a winning percentage above 400 as a conference. So
and
it's really
the winning percentage above 400 was with a minimum of 20 games, right?
Right, but also if you play less than 20 games and to fill out, say you play 15 games, if you could add 5 losses onto the end of that and your winning percentage is still above 400, then you would still be in. Like the example
that
they use, the example they use that if you were 10-9. You would still be in because if you added the 20th game as a loss, you'd be 500, which is still above 400, so you still qualify.
That makes sense.
So it's very conference-centered, and it's kind of a way around the allegations that this violates like antitrust laws because it's basically the big conferences have almost conspired to keep the little conferences out because they have no way to really get in the championship that limits competition, so that could be argued that that's illegal. So this is kind of a way around that. In that it's saying that, okay, well, if these smaller conferences want to have an automatic bid to this, then, you know, go out and prove it on the field and do it against the top conferences.
Yeah, you made a joke about, like, oh, of course Mountain West would be one of the automatic qualifiers, but I don't really think it's self-serving. I think the Mountain West has been a good conference, and they beat the crap out of the Pac-10 last year. I don't remember what the numbers were, but they destroyed them. Like, it wasn't even close. Like, they really killed the Pac-10. And to see what Utah did in their bowl game against Alabama was really impressive. So I think, you know, schools like, I think it's a shame that Utah didn't get to prove whether or not they deserved it. You know, I wasn't of the belief that they should have been ranked number one at the end of the year, but it's a shame that we didn't get to figure out whether or not they should have been because they won all the games on their schedule and they had a pretty good schedule and they beat a good team in Alabama. So I think this is a really good idea, actually.
Well, I agree with Kyle on the fact that this is a joke if only 12 people are deciding this. Like, how is this any better than the original college football system where you had, like, 100 voters, you know. This is 12 people is a joke.
I agree that the Mountain West definitely, at this point, needs to get an automatic bid, or at least the possibility of getting an automatic bid, because if you look at them last year, I mean, yeah, Utah proved that they belong there, but BYU and TCU were both extremely competitive and played well against the top teams. TCU, after a very rough first half against Oklahoma, held their own and was one of the only teams to actually be able to stop that offense. I mean, TCU's defense was for real last year, and they didn't get a chance to prove that, which is unfortunate. And I would like to see them play in a playoff system because for Utah, there's a big difference being able to get up for just that one big game and keep it for, you know, 2-3 more games against the top competition. There's always that chance that they could pull off the upset in that one game. But, you know, sustain that for 3 games would be, I think, great to see. And I think Utah last year could have done it, but you never get to see that unless they change the system.
Yeah, the things I see with this whole conference thing that are interesting are, even though it's proposed in a way that's supposed to give the little guy a chance, it's probably still not going to work out unless they do something different. Because the main 6 conferences, the power conferences, not including the Mountain West, are still going to win all their games against the smaller conferences. They're still going to schedule crappy teams and beat them. So what has to happen is I think the NCAA needs to step in and make a schedule where they have to play. You could even have like a conference tie-in where like each conference should have to play a certain number of games against each of the other conferences every year and allot it to the different teams and make it like randomized, not where you're playing the bottom feeders of the bottom conferences to do that to boost your winning percentage. Because otherwise, this is just a way around, you know, the antitrust allegations because they're still going to be the main 6 conferences. And then the other thing that I think is really cool too, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which the SEC or ACC would fall out of this 400 winning percentage, mm-hmm. but say they're on the line. It comes down to the end of the year. The SEC and the ACC are both fighting to stay in that top, you know, division. Think about the last week when you have Florida, Florida State, Georgia, Georgia Tech, and USC Clemson, mm-hmm. South Carolina Clemson. All in the last week, they could all make a difference in that. That would be incredible. That would be the most amazing thing. And this really, to me, would strengthen conference pride a lot. Like, it would make it the cool thing about college football with the pageantry and everything, now you would have conference pageantry, and more so than you already do. And I think that'd be really cool. And also, if you were to include bowl games in that, which I would, because I think the bowl games are already meaningless, and an argument against the playoffs has been, it'll totally wipe out the bowls, they'll be totally meaningless. Well, now they kind of have something to play for. Like, they're playing for their conference. It's kind of like when they made the Major League Baseball All-Star Game have a tie-in to home field advantage in the World Series. It's kind of that same line of thinking.
You touched on it just barely, that they won't be able to play the bottom feeders of these little conferences because the top teams in these smaller conferences can hang with most of the teams in the big conferences. But if these better teams in the small conferences do get their chance to play the big conferences, they're playing them on the road all the time. No respectable team is going to go into Boise, go into Utah, go into TCU and play them, because that's just asking to be upset, and they're not going to do it. They can't afford, because with the BCS, one loss, you're done. You can't afford that type of loss. I think with a playoff system, you'll see teams more willing to accept that kind of deal because they know they can't afford that one loss. They're all right accepting that, you know, they're going to put themselves out there by going to these places, and it's going to make college football that much better.
Well, McCall is right about the conference pride. The shades of soccer-like relegation are awesome. Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. But I want to say, if this is going to work, then Notre Dame has to be forced to join a conference. They can't be, like, their own entity. Notre Dame's not bigger than any of these other conferences are.
Right, absolutely. It's ridiculous. They need to be in the Big Ten. It doesn't make any sense why they're not.
I got a couple things here. First of all, I think they should, McCall is talking about having the NCAA make the schedules for the schools instead of having the schools do it, which I think is probably a good idea. And one rule that I'd really like to see is that you're not allowed to schedule 1AA teams on your thing. I know Appalachian State beat Michigan. That was huge. But that was the 1%, you know, the 99%, you know, percent of the time they're going to win. And the 1%, Appalachian State finally got a win. But I think we could all probably agree that it's not a good idea to have these major schools from these major conferences beating the crap out of AA schools. It doesn't mean anything. And the other thing is, I think Bobby's definitely 100% right. You'll see a lot more matchups with, like, the upper Mountain West teams with the power conference teams, because if they lose one game, it doesn't kill them and it doesn't keep them from winning a national championship. With a playoff system, you'll see better matchups throughout the year that you've always wondered about what would happen if these two teams met. Now you'll get to find out, because if a big school takes a loss, they can still rebound later, and we don't have to watch Ohio State play a crappy Big Ten schedule and then beat up Youngstown State and all these other stupid schools along the way also.
You hit it right on the head with the 1AA thing. That should count as a penalty against your conference winning percentage if you play a 1AA team. Wow. I mean, that would deter people from doing that, because it doesn't serve a purpose. You don't get anything from it. And then also with your second point, that was a good point also, because the reason why it's not going to happen is the major conferences still hold the power in this. The SEC, ACC, Big Ten, Big 12, Pac-10, those guys are still calling the shots, whether we want to believe that or not. And they haven't wanted to go play these smaller schools. They have nothing to gain from this system. So I don't know why they would agree to this. That's going to be the biggest roadblock.
I have a question. Is any of this realistic? Like, is any of this even have a chance? I mean, you're talking about some radical changes.
They have to get TV on their side first. That's the biggest thing. And, I mean, I was thinking about this already today. Like, ESPN sold out by canceling Playmakers because they bowed to the NFL. I just got that in the mail today, so that's why it was on my mind.
Great show.
I've been watching it for the last 4 days.
No. So, I mean, I don't know any reason why they would stand up to this. I mean, they have the contract for the BCS games now. Like, they would need to stand up and say, like, this needs to be a playoff system.
I really think that it's not all the big conferences. A lot of the big conferences are open to it. I mean, SEC, they proposed a playoff system.
SEC,
I mean, it was only a 4-team. ACC did
too. SEC and ACC supported a +1 system.
They supported a +1, and NCAA shot it down because they said, if you implement a playoff system, it's just going to expand. So, I mean, there's no reason to not open it up at 8, which I've always been for. 8 games, an 8-team playoff is perfect, I think. You're really going to see the arguments coming from the Big Ten and the Pac-10 and the Rose Bowl, because they are so set on their ways over there. They make their money. They know they're going to make their money. And, you know, they'll say 1,000 times that it's not about the money, but it's 100% about the money. Everyone knows that. Why they keep saying it's not, I don't know. But until I really don't think the NCAA or a committee of conference leaders is going to get it approved. I hate to say that it needs government intervention, but it does. It really does, because if you're going for the unanimous vote, you're never going to get it with the Pac-10 and Big Ten, unless you just throw millions of dollars at them to accept the deal. So you're going to have someone bigger than the NCAA come in and do it.
Well, I mean, the thing you could get the NCAA with is if you can prove that this violates, like, monopolistic rules, which it very well could if you get a sympathetic judge.
I think the government's more concerned with the crumbling economy at this point than the BCS.
They're talking about this. Their congressmen are, like, responding to this. They always want to dabble in sports.
Okay, they should be more concerned with the economy than the BCS. Yeah. But anyway, let's move on.
They should be, but there are just dozens and dozens of committees in the government. And you're going to tell me that one about, like, a trail up in Wyoming is really making that big of a difference? I'm sure people up in Wyoming is probably fussing about it, but not every committee is built around the economy and trying to fix it.
Let's not get into that. Everybody should be focused on the economy right now. Let's move on to deep rate.
Right, well, Bob's absolutely right. It's all about money. But so do you think there's any way these big schools are going to allow the NCAA to like make their schedules for them? There's no way.
That's
way too much to lose.
That's why this probably isn't going to happen.
None of this is going to happen. But what happened? What it said in the ESPN article that reported this, and they had somebody from the Mountain West quoted, and the guy was saying that the main purpose of this, we don't think it's going to happen, but we want to open the dialogue. And that's really what's important about this, is that there's a formal proposal submitted and people are going to talk about it. People in positions to change things. There's going to be open dialogue. And that increases the chance of them hammering out something later. What Bob was saying, the SEC and the ACC already supported a +1 system last year, and other conferences shot it down because they're just saying that it'll expand in the future, which is 100% right. It will expand in the future, but that's good. We all want that. So hopefully, eventually, they get their foot in the door and it expands later. And as far as the Notre Dame thing, I can't for the life of me figure out why they haven't joined the Big Ten yet for football. And the Big East already has 16 teams for basketball, and I'm actually working out a realignment thing that could possibly happen. And it involves the Big East dropping Notre Dame and having them join the Big Ten for both football and basketball, thus giving them 12 schools instead of 11. So I don't know why that doesn't happen. Geographically, it makes sense, and based on some rivalries that they have with teams there.
I think the big problem, the Big Ten has that hidden 11 in their logo. I don't know if you've ever noticed that, so they're going to have to redesign that totally. It's like teams. That costs money. But,
well, hopefully they'd be smart to rename the entire conference at that point.
Yeah, you would think, but they can't be the Big 12. The cold 12.
Well, I mean, if you think at one point they didn't have 10 teams, so they were something, I think it was like the Big North or something of that sort,
right, yeah,
before they were the Big Ten, so they can just go back to that.
But let's not get lost here. I mean, the SEC and the ACC are not really the good guys in this fight. Yeah, they want a +1 system, but that's very self-serving. An 18 playoff where you're welcoming in these other conferences, that's totally different. I don't think they're all about that. And John Swofford's the head of the BCS right now.
But I think they're trying to get something. Like, they're just trying to get them to give something, because it's a big jump from no playoff system to 16-team free-for-all, but it's not that big of a jump from no playoff system to +1 system, and I think that's what the quote-unquote good guys are trying to do.
Well, let's get into something else here. Their proposed venues and the way that would work for this 18 playoff. They want to have the four main BCS bowls be the quarterfinal, and then kind of see what happens for the semifinals and the finals, propose it. I don't like that. I think that if you're going to have conferences get bids into this that may not totally be deserving, like, you know, say the Mountain West is kind of down, but based on their last 2 years, they have that 400 winning percentage, their conference champion is going to automatically qualify for this playoff system. And yeah, sometimes they may not be the most deserving. I think you should seed them, not have conference tie-ins to bowls anymore. Forget that. That doesn't really matter. Have them seed the teams and do it a seeded playoff. 1-8, 2-7, on down the line, and the top four seeds play at home. You have home games. Then you still have four games left. You have that extra game, the fifth BCS game, the two semifinals, and the finals. And I think you rotate that between the four BCS games, because when you've got two fan bases, Jeremy Foley brought this point up in the past, that if you have two fan bases traveling across country, if you have these games spread out at the BCS games, you're going to have potentially Florida fans going from like Pasadena to Miami to New Orleans in three straight weeks. It's not like people aren't going to show up, but I don't think that's the best way to do it. And I think, I mean, this is kind of following an NFL-type mentality with the conference tie-ins, just like divisional tie-ins. And yeah, like, you know, the Cardinals, everyone said they shouldn't have been in the playoffs this year, and they went to the Super Bowl and almost won it. And the same thing could happen with one of these smaller schools, but I think there should be a home field advantage and then rotate the BCS games to the other four.
I agree that there shouldn't be conference tie-ins to the games anymore, but you're never going to get, you know, Citigroup, you know, Fiesta, Tostillo, whatever, you know, all the, you know, main organizers to give up that title. And you got to keep at least those names for the first round, and then the championship have that same rotating one that they have been doing, where it just rotates to whichever one it was supposed to be in the first place. The semifinal, I guess, just offered up to anyone who's willing to pay the money. I'm pretty sure you'll find people. But home games, I agree that it will be ridiculous, but people are going to pay the money. And in college football, home games mean everything. You're not going to see too many upsets on the road. You just don't. Home field advantage gives people way too big of an advantage, and I don't think it'd be fair.
Yeah, I agree with Bob. Like, the home field advantage in football means more than anything else. And there's no way you're going to see all these upsets if these games are all played at home. There's no way Florida's going to lose to, like, a Utah in the swamp.
So Florida won the national championship this year and lost to Mississippi at home. LSU won the national championship game last year. Did they lose to Kentucky at home, or was that on the road?
But
they almost lost to Florida at home. That's the same environment in this situation where a loss basically eliminates you.
It's not the same environment at all.
I'll go one further. I agree that home field advantage is a huge advantage, but then on top of that, I say, so what? So then you get something for being the top four teams, and the eighth team who's sneaking in with an automatic bid from the Mountain West Conference isn't on equal playing field with the number one team who played in the SEC or some really tough conference and went undefeated for the year. Give them something for doing well throughout the season and seed them and let them get a home game.
So you're still slighting the smaller schools?
No, you're absolutely not.
No, if they prove it on the field, they have an opportunity to be in the top four. They've got a voice on this panel, on this proposal.
I mean, I just don't know who's going to... I don't know who's going to make the decision that's the number one team. That's the number two. Is it going to be this panel? Is it going to be?
It's not going to be anyone because none of this is happening.
It needs to be people. It needs to be something with the pulse, not a computer.
Because you're always going to have the argument of this team is better than that team, but they happen to play a weaker opponent, so they have a better record. Why should they be the number one team? But if you're just going off records and stuff, you're going to have bad teams. It's a really. I think the whole point is you're trying to prove who's the best team, not who played well enough in the regular season to get that home field advantage. You want to see who's the best team, period. And the only way to do that is neutral stadium.
The NFL does not use neutral stadiums. Does anyone here have a problem with how the NFL is designed?
The NFL is completely different than college football. The atmosphere in an NFL game is nowhere near a college football atmosphere.
I was at the Miami Dolphins playoff game, and the fans were pitiful and terrible and nothing at all compared to a college football environment. One yelling fan was screaming at all the other fans for not being loud. So the home field advantage argument in the NFL, comparing NFL to college football, is ridiculous.
When you have an Orange Bowl first round game between like Virginia Tech and like Washington State, you think it's really going to be full and rocking and crazy. It's not going to be that cool. It's really not.
Well, my argument.
Washington State.
I don't know why you put Washington State into BCS game, but
On the flip side, think of UF versus USC in the swamp. Like that's
a madhouse. I mean, this is what college football should be. With the main four bowls, they would not have any problem taking the semifinals and the finals over the quarterfinals.
But they can't.
That's better for them.
Only three do it.
Right, you have the fourth team in this proposal there are 10 teams that would make the BCS, and there would be an extra BCS game that really doesn't mean that much, but it's still a BCS game. Mm. You still make it, you still get the money, still generate the money for your conference, people will still show up. You have that, and that's a rotating thing. You get that one out of 4 years. The other three, you're making more money than you ever have before.
I'm just saying, look at every other playoff system in college sports. They're all, sure, baseball and softball and stuff, they start off at a venue, but they all end up at a neutral place.
Georgia hosted gymnastics.
But it rotates. Okay, it's a rotating thing.
You just made our point for us. They start off, the playoff system start off with home games, then move to a neutral system, which is exactly what this would do. The finals and semifinals would be at neutral sites, where the quarters would just be at home. It's the same thing as hosting a regional or a super regional and then moving to the World Series.
I'm saying it comes down, they put it somewhere where it is neutral when it matters, and you're going to tell me that that opening round isn't going to matter when there's only eight teams.
That's the
important part, is that there's just such few teams that you got to go neutral right away.
I don't necessarily agree
with it at all. I don't think it's correct at all. I think that you're throwing away. You could conceivably have your top eight. You could have the top four teams be undefeated or one loss, and the next four have two or three losses. Those top four teams deserve something. They should get something. They shouldn't have to go all the way across the country and play another team.
Have two teams that are undefeated and four or five teams, next five that have two losses each, and then how are you going to separate that?
Well,
you just can't do it.
Yeah, you can. You can separate it based on like what you brought up earlier, strength of schedule and things like that. I mean, you can work it out. We have brains.
Which, like you said, will reward the teams for playing the tougher out-of-conference schedule at the beginning.
Absolutely.
And now that we brought that full circle, let's move on. We're going to move on to some men's basketball talk. All right, D, for the team lost to Mississippi State a little earlier this week. Tell me about that loss. What went wrong? What happened?
Yeah, Florida loses to Mississippi State Wednesday in beautiful Starkville. Mississippi State runs this unusual four-guard offense where they have Jarvis Bernardo in the middle down low, and they have four smaller guards. Their power forward 6'3". So that really spread the floor on Florida a lot. That really hurt them, especially since they have problems defending the perimeter athletically. Mississippi State makes 10 threes. Bernardo plays well. This is a horrible loss for Florida. Barring a loss to Kentucky Saturday, this is probably rock bottom for the Gators. So this was a devastating blow to their tournament chances.
and as Evan wrote in a column earlier this week, you think it's over, it's done for the team, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was the final nail in the coffin. I wrote an obituary for the team in Thursday's Alligator, and I don't know, I just can't see them recovering from this, you know, either on the court or mentally. They just can't come back from a loss like this, unless by some crazy chance they win the SEC tournament, which I can't imagine happening. I mean, Georgia did it last year, but that was a fluke. I mean, I don't know, I can't see it happening.
Walter Hodge today told me that if George can do it, why not us? So, but another thing I want to get to is late in the game when Florida's trying to mount a comeback, the final few minutes, Nick Kalathis is sitting on the bench for that. Billy Donovan said today that he wasn't punishing Nick, but Nick put up a really bad three late in the game. Afterwards, Billy kind of sat him down. So I'm of the opinion that probably was a punishment type thing. Does Nick Kalathis need to be on a bench in that situation regardless?
No, and I thought the quote that you ran the other day was way out of line. Not that you ran it, but that Billy Donovan said it, where he was chewing out Kalathis for trying to do too much and all this other nonsense about how he needs to make the guys around him better. He does nothing but make the team better. I mean, he throws great passes all the time. He's averaging 7 assists per game, which you then told me Billy Donovan was saying in a press conference or the media that you had that, oh, in this system, if you're a good player and you're playing point guard, you're going to get 7 assists per game. And I think Taurean Green was a pretty good player, and he averaged under 4 assists per game for his career here running point guard with really talented guys around him. So I think that's a terrible point by him. And I don't understand why Billy Donovan would go ahead and call out a guy who's given everything he's had the whole season. He's exerted as much effort as you possibly can with a group of scrubs essentially around him. And to call him out and make it seem like he's part of the problem is irresponsible, I think, by Donovan. I think it's way out of line.
Yeah, this is not the time to teach lessons when you have 2 games left and you have to win them both to get in the tournament. Like, your
this is why you don't teach lessons.
Exactly. You don't have enough time for this to pay off in the long run. You just have to win now. So you do whatever it takes to win. Obviously, having Kalathis on the floor is big for that.
And when he pulled Kalathis, the Gators were within 8 points. I mean, it wasn't completely over yet. There was still 3 minutes left. Anything can happen in that kind of situation. So pulling your best player with the game still narrowly in reach was foolish.
And in that kind of a game, if Nick Kalathis isn't going to be the one to do it, who is? They have another go-to guy.
That's a great point. If you've watched the team at all this year, when it comes down to crunch time and everyone's kind of like timidly staring at each other, like who's going to take this shot, who's going to make this play, it's Kalathis every time. He's the only one on the court who has a plan when he has the ball in his hand. He knows where guys are on the court. He knows how to make plays. Everybody else is just playing off of him at all times. Or Irving Walker is the only other person with any kind of offensive creativity who can make plays for himself or other people. And I think it was unbelievable to see him pulled and put on the bench like that. You're pretty much just forfeiting at that point.
Yeah, and here's Nick's biggest problem. Nick Kalathis' biggest problem is that he's so much better than the other guys he plays with that they can't handle the passes he's throwing around. Like,
he's too talented.
You see it every game.
He'll throw passes and guys will get hit in the hands and they're like, what the hell's going on? If Kalathis had better players around him, he would be infinitely a better player.
So do you think this kind of move by Donovan will discourage Kalathis from returning next season?
I mean, I'm not going to go conspiracy theory and say he's, like, sabotaging his draft stock or anything. But, I mean, I think if Nick's going to get drafted in the first round, he's going. I don't think there's any question about that.
I don't think this really has any effect on whether or not he goes. I think the issue is broader than this. I think they probably have a good relationship behind closed doors. So there's some other kind of thing going on here. But I don't know if he's trying to fire up the rest of the guys to come to his defense and kind of bond over this, but I'm not really sure.
Do you buy what he said about it being a learning experience for Kalathis?
No, I mean, what's he going to say? Yeah, I sat him down. Like, he should have, but I don't know. There's no way that helped the team in that situation.
All right, are we all totally convinced? I know you wrote an obituary. Are we totally convinced that if they beat Kentucky and have 9 wins in the conference, go 9-7, they knock Kentucky down a peg who they're competing with for a bid, and then they win, like, 2 games in the SEC tournament, do they have any chance of getting in?
They can still make it, definitely. With a win against Kentucky, that gives them 9. And then if they win a couple, they're going to have to win probably multiple games in the tournament at this point. But that will at least put them firmly on the bubble in the discussion. The stat that hurts them the most is that they're 2-7 on the road. Mm-hmm. And the tournament committee wants to see that you can win away from home. That's one of their big criteria. And the only time they've really proven that is when they beat Washington on a neutral site early in the year. And the early in the year wins don't count as much as the late in the year wins. And they haven't proven that they can go into somebody else's house and win, which is a huge determining factor in the teams that they put in. The 2-7 number is just not good enough.
Yeah, the Kentucky game's an elimination game. Loser's done for the NCAA tournament. But they, looking at the way that SEC tournament's going to break down, if they beat Kentucky, they're going to be the third seed in the East, and they'll play Alabama in the first round. If they lose, they'll be lower. They'll play Arkansas, probably. So either of those games are probably winnable. And then depending if they win either of those games, they're going to play Auburn or Mississippi State, I believe. So that's another winnable game. So if they can beat Kentucky and get those two wins, all of a sudden you have a chance again.
I agree this is an elimination game as far as getting a at-large bid is concerned. But Evan said that they're, you know, they're probably not going to win that SEC tournament, which is true. They probably won't. But I'm definitely not going to say that they can't, because it's happened not only with Georgia last year, who was worse, I think we can agree, than UF is heading into the postseason. It's happened with Syracuse in the Big East recently. Happened last year with San Diego in the West Coast Conference. They Gonzaga went down. St. Mary's didn't win it. And they ended up getting an automatic bid, which messed up a lot of teams. But we see it happen kind of a lot in the conference tournaments. And I'm not going to rule a decent team out of it altogether, although I do think it's unlikely.
I mean, I really don't think they will. But so far this season, they've done everything pretty much unconventionally. Everything they were supposed to win, they've lost. Anything that they were supposed to lose, they've won, really. So, I mean, somewhat, but I mean, you know what? This team likes to surprise people. Why not do it then?
The point I was going to make about what Kyle said is that the situation that the Gators are in, I think, is so different from last year's Georgia team because they're just mentally out of it more than anything. Georgia was a crappy team, and they knew they were a crappy team. This is a Gators team that's a crappy team, and it thinks, you know, it was thinking during the season that it had a better chance. And so just I don't know that they can come back from from all these losses just emotionally, mentally, to come together as a team for this tournament run and make it happen.
And as amazing as it sounds, they still think they have a really good chance. So the SEC,
well, they tell the media they think they have a really good chance.
I really think they believe it too. I think there's, for some reason, there's this air of optimism. So, you know, maybe they can get it done.
Is anyone else here shocked at the way they lost to Mississippi State? I mean, weren't they down by like 20 plus at one point?
I think it was as bad as 19 or 18.
Okay, is anyone just blown away by that? I know it's on the road. Mississippi State's not that great. They know they have to win. Their back's against the wall, and they come out like that. That really shocked me.
Two things about that real quick. I said while we were watching the game in the office, like, remember when a Mississippi State game in virtually any sport was an automatic win for Florida? And then second, I said, Florida will come back to within 6 points and then lose tragically for them. And they got back to exactly within six, and I felt pretty good about my prediction for moving on.
And well, let's not discount the curse of Dan Mullen.
yeah, it's begun.
Well, I'm going to discount the curse of Dan Mullen, but I'm not at all surprised that they lost at this point. I mean, I don't expect anything from them anymore after they lost the way they did Tennessee at home. And for them to go on the road, it's just like they cannot win on the road for whatever reason. I think, going back to what I said last podcast, I think they react really poorly to big moments when the crowd gets into it. And also the problem is you see them come back, you know, Adam made a prediction, they're going to come back a little bit and they're going to lose at the end. They don't have a crunch time scorer, as great as Calathes is, who puts the team on his back at the end of the game. They don't have a Devin Downey or a Jody Meeks or a guy like that who, when the game's on the line, it's okay, I'm going to just dump in as many points as we need to come back. I think, actually, Urban Walker has tried to be that guy, hasn't been able to, you know, I don't fault him for that, but he's kind of been the guy taking the big shots at the end of the game. And I think that speaks to the fact that Calathes is not the selfish player that Donovan's making him out to be. I'd like to see him actually just go into the mode where I'm taking the shot no matter what at the end of games. And I don't think he's done that, and I think UF has suffered from it as a result.
Well, I think we all agree that Nick's the best player on the team, but I think Kyle's right on the Urban Walker thing. I think he is a mentality those other guys really don't have. I think he's willing to take the shot at the end of the game.
I was looking through some of the most recent box scores. Against Tennessee in the final 2 minutes, I think Walker had 8 points on 3 of 4 shooting, and Calathes had 2, I think, on 2 free throws. And then also Walker iced the game at Alabama. He made like the last 6 free throws or something. I mean, coming down the stretch, he seems like he's been the more clutch guy.
Yeah, I agree that he's been maybe a little more clutch. He definitely has that mentality where he's not afraid of the shot like a Dan Werner is, or maybe like a Chandler Parsons or somebody like that. But it made me cringe. I don't know if it made you guys cringe when he seemed like he was bringing them back against Tennessee, or I think it was against Tennessee. That was the game, right, where he started, he hit a couple threes late, brought him back. Yeah. And then he gets a wide open look from three, with down 3 points, or down 3 points, he gets a wide open look, as wide open as you can be, and Scottie Hobson closes out on him and just gets a piece of the ball somehow. And if anybody else shoots that ball, it's not blocked. But what also got me is, I know for a fact he can shoot that ball where it doesn't get blocked, and I thought that's just like a young mistake not to make sure he got it over the guy who's closing out on him. Like, I don't know how he lets that shot get blocked because he was wide open as you can be.
Are you saying because he's 5'8", he got blocked or no?
I don't know. You pick. It's either because he's 5'8", or because he didn't have the mental awareness to make sure he got enough arc on that ball, but you cannot get that shot blocked. It's too good of a look.
He normally puts plenty of arc on the ball when anyone's nearby. And he took some off on this one.
I agree. I think that's exactly what happened. He just didn't. I don't know what happened, but he didn't make sure that he got it over Hobson.
All right, so we're going to move on to some reader mail, as we promised in the last several weeks. We got an email from Mike Perrone, who is a friend of the show, for full disclosure. His email said, "Could it be possible that Billy Donovan is not as good of a coach as everyone thinks he is? He's having trouble rebuilding, makes odd recruiting choices," in parentheses it says, "two point guards under 6 feet in the last 2 years, and Dan Werner, and can't seem to keep players from leaving early. Could it be that he got lucky with one recruiting class and is riding the wave of success left by the 04s? What do we think about that?"
You can't say Billy Donovan's not a good coach. I don't think there's an argument there. Even before he won the titles, he built this program from nothing. He went to Final Fours. You can't say. Maybe he's made some bad recruiting choice in the last couple of years, but he's not a bad coach.
He may be a good coach who was made into an incredible coach by having a good team for a few years. I mean, he doesn't. It's not just because he's not like Dean Smith or Mike Krzyzewski or something doesn't mean he's not, you know, a really good college basketball coach. But I think maybe he was put up on too high of a pedestal with those back-to-back championships, and now he's being judged by too harsh of a standard.
I mean, I don't think he got lucky with the recruiting class because he's had good players before. He brings in good players. He got a little lucky that, you know, all four of them lived up to the, you know, their potential, and for some of them went right through the roof that people set for them. So that was lucky, but as in just getting lucky being a good recruiter, he has been. He still is. He still brings in good players. It seems as though he's kind of misevaluating some of them, I guess, and seeing how they fit in as a whole together. It's just kind of picking up good players and not really seeing how they would mesh together, it seems.
I think Billy Donovan is a good coach, but I think he's become very overrated. I think he's made a lot of really questionable decisions with the style. He's been unwilling to adapt the way he would like his teams to play to his personnel, which I think Urban Meyer, he should take a page out of his book, because when he came in 2006, it was the second year, and they won a title, it was because he said, "I'm going to put my system on the back burner, we're going to adjust to the players." And they haven't had the players to play the up-tempo game that he wants to play, and he refuses to change anything. And he's played the small lineup, and Dan Werner's been playing the power forward, and things haven't been working out. And I think that's a direct result of recruiting, because he cannot recruit with the big boys. I was looking at the last two McDonald's All-American games and the rosters this year's and last year's, and it's disgusting. Like, if you go on there and look, UNC had 4 McDonald's All-Americans last year, and they got 4 more commits this year. So they've had 8 McDonald's All-Americans in the last 2 years. Billy Donovan will have brought in 3, and one of them left the program. One of them was Jay Lucas, who I'm not sure how he was a McDonald's All-American to start with. But it's really just he's not able to recruit the way these other programs are. You have guys like Dan Werner and Jonathan Mitchell and stuff like that coming in who aren't panning out, and they're not big-time players, and I think he's not doing a good enough job recruiting.
Well, first of all, let's not start comparing UNC and Four. They're different programs. I mean, UNC is a historically great program. As much as it pains me to say that while McCall's over here freaking out. And second of all, I'm going to defend the recruiting of Dan Werner Brimley. I know he hasn't panned out to be the greatest player in the world, but at the time, he was the Mr. Basketball in the state of New Jersey. He was the New Jersey State's like all-time scoring leader. He was going to an ACC school whose coach got fired at NC State. So, at the time, that's a good pickup, is it not? I mean,
no, I think I can name more impact players from Alaska than I can from New Jersey. Yeah, I can tell you Mario Chalmers and Trajan Langdon have been great players. I can't tell you anyone from New Jersey who's been a great player. So, I don't think just because he was, like, you got to go look at the guy, see the competition he's playing against. It's not impressive. He ended up having no real position. Can we agree on that? Was he a shooter? Is he a big man? I still don't know, and I've watched him play for 3 years.
I think he's probably a three.
The thing with UNC being different than Florida, they won back-to-back national championships. If you can't sell that to kids coming in, to these big-time recruits, Jeremy Foley's got to open his checkbook and start writing some checks like everybody else is. I don't know what the problem is, but how do you win back-to-back titles and have made another Final Four, and you're in a position to become the SEC power for years to come, and you can't get the kids in here to do that?
That's still different than saying I'm North Carolina or I'm UCLA or like Kansas. I mean, there's tradition there.
I mean, one of the things he mentions in the email is that he can't seem to get players, key players from leaving early, and he blamed the the team's lack of success on Murray Spates at one point, apparently. And everyone's freaking out because Nick Calathes is going to leave. But that's part of the game. People leave early every year. I mean, even more so in college basketball and college football, people are always leaving early. You have to be ready for that. He's got to have known that Nick Calathes could leave early. He's got to know that, you know, a 6'11" big man might leave early. He's got to see that happening, and he's got to recruit replacements right away. Not maybe 2-3 years down the line because he thinks the guy's going to stay. He's got to, every year, he's got to have a 6'11" guy. You know, that point guard who can make the plays. He's got to have those people every year. And if he hasn't realized that now, he's got to change that.
I mean, yeah, it's tough for the people leaving early, but it's not like his recruiting class has been barren. I mean, Calathes, Jay Lucas, I mean, Chandler Parsons even. These were big prospects. Kenny Boynton, whoever the other guys are that all have good rankings that are coming in this year. I mean, he's getting good players, but there is a big difference between Florida and schools like UNC and Duke and schools that are on TV all the time and schools that have the tradition, like a real tradition. Florida won back-to-back championships, but it's not the same. UNC's on TV almost every game. I mean, I can't miss it.
Is there a difference in tradition between, like, an Oklahoma who's getting Blake Griffin and Willie Warren and big players like that, or Villanova who brings in McDonald's All-Americans all the time? Like, there are programs out there that seem to get these huge players that come in and play, and I would argue that their tradition's just – it's the same as coming to Florida. Well, Florida's been better in recent years.
Oklahoma's tradition is worse, but Taylor Griffin was at Oklahoma before Blake Griffin was there. So
which I'm sure was
a huge factor.
Fine, but I'm sure that's part of the reason you go after Taylor Griffin is to get Blake Griffin.
Okay, fair enough.
Just as the Southeast gets the best football players, because that's what the Southeast does is football, the Northeast and schools in the Mid-Atlantic region and schools up north of the Southeast get the best players because that's where basketball is more popular.
But
it's pretty simple.
Let's not pretend like there's not good basketball players in the state of Florida, because there are.
Well, yeah. All right, let's move on to another comment. We had this as a comment on Tennessee Gamers by somebody named Cleveland Gator with an 8 for the ATO. That's clever. The letter says, "I'm an avid follower of the basketball team, and hopefully someone can read this and respond." So we're going to. First, our strength of schedule is a joke. Most likely, besides winning out Mississippi State and Kentucky, we'd have to fare well in the SEC tournament to make it to the dance. Watching the game yesterday with other alumni, we believe that Donovan needs to amp up the difficulty of non-conference games in the fall in order for the team to learn their lessons and prepare themselves. Does anyone find any validity behind such a theory?
It's definitely true that they're hurt by a weak non-conference schedule, but they're hurt more by playing real teams and losing to them.
No, that's absolutely not true. You have to play a good non-conference schedule to get into the NCAA tournament. This is why Arizona gets in the tournament every single year, because they play a great non-conference. When you go and you schedule big-time schools, if they went and they played 3-4 games against UNC, Duke, teams like that, or teams from the Big East, they're freebies. They're absolute freebies. Losses do not hurt you in those games. It means nothing if you go ahead and lose to a big team. But if you beat one of those teams, it helps your resume infinitely. And they need to get back in the tournament. That's important for this program. If they keep missing the tournament, it's going to make it even harder for him to bring in these recruits. But I thought last year, that was something I pointed to at the beginning of last year. I said, this non-conference is an absolute joke. And people told me, well, the team's really young, so they don't want to get the crap beat out of them and be down mentally for the rest of the season. I bought that a little bit. But this year is the same thing. You had two potential games against real teams when they went out and played Syracuse and Washington. And other than that, it was nothing. And that's not good enough. You have to put games in there to help boost your resume for later on.
Yeah, Kyle's right. Let's look at what Bruce Pearl and Tennessee are doing. They played Memphis this year, Gonzaga twice, Temple. And all of a sudden, they're a solid team, and they're a tournament team because they played those games. They're not penalized for losing to Gonzaga. That only helps them.
Florida couldn't beat Mississippi State and Georgia in the throes of an NCAA tournament run. If they go play UNC and they go play real teams that, like outside the SEC, real teams that belong in the tournament without a doubt, they're going to get, I think, exposed and shown in the scope of what real basketball is to what they are. They're not at the same level. And I think just anyone who would actually watch games like that would see how far below they are.
But I'll argue that teams who play in November aren't the same teams you're playing now. So they almost beat Syracuse earlier in the season. So they can win some of those games.
It doesn't matter if you get exposed. So what? So what if they go play UNC at UNC and lose by 20? Who the hell cares? They're expected to do that anyway. It doesn't mean anything. You have to go play those games because it's going to help you later if you win. It's an absolute win-win situation. There's no reason not to schedule games against big-time competition. They need to get in the preseason. They need to go out to Maui. They need to play in the Alaskan Shootout. They need to get in these big tournaments that kick off the seasons, log a couple big wins that look good later so that they can get back in the NCAA tournament.
going 13-2 to start the season and then 16-2 after three games of SEC play really didn't help them much at all this year.
Exactly. It would have if they could finish, you know, above water in the conference.
All right, let's move on to the second part of this comment. It says, Calathes looks completely frustrated. Watching his facial expressions on TV the past couple games, he looks completely fed up with the team's performance. At this point, he appears to be playing for himself in order to impress recruiters. And then the question is, are there talks of him going into the draft? Short answer, yes.
I got to make one more point about the last name. Sorry, before we moved on. The 04s, when they won their first title, what did they do at the beginning of the year? They went to the Coaches versus Cancer tournament, one of the big kickoff tournaments for the season, surprised everybody and won the thing, and that just started all the momentum. So I'm sorry to go back to that, but that
they
was
were,
an important
they
point.
Were good.
But you didn't, nobody knew they were good coming
at the
into
time
that,
that season. No one had any...
But they were good.
But you
that's
didn't...
The difference.
Maybe
you,
they were good for playing those games and getting battle tested early.
You can't write off a team before this even starts just because you think they're going to be bad. No one thought anything of the 04s that first year. They weren't in the top 25. No one thought anything of them coming into the season. They play well in a couple big games, and all of a sudden, they have all the confidence in the world heading into late in the season.
Well, maybe they
just
because
this team, because
he knew he would have a good team, whereas now he knows
effect.
He doesn't.
I was saying, people looked at like Joe Kim Noah, like Eloy Vargas now. So, I mean, there's no reason to say this team won't get better in the future. But, hey, moving on.
All right, so back to the Calathes thing. I mean, you mentioned it earlier. He's fed up with his team's performance. Do you feel like that's the way it actually is?
He's never going to say it, but I think that's the case. I think he's a good team guy. He likes being at Florida and all the other stuff. But after a while, it comes to a point where like you get tired of losing. You get tired of playing with guys who can't keep up with you. And I think that's where he's at.
All right, I think we're going to move on from basketball then, and we're going to talk a little bit about some Florida baseball here. All right, Bobby, recap what happened in the baseball team's midweek games this week.
All right, coming off of last weekend's awful performance against Miami where they got swept, they went away for the first time to Stetson, you know, the treacherous fields over there. And, they used Jeff Barfield, who's supposed to be their closer, to start the game. He went, I think, 6 2/3 innings, only gave up 1 or 2 runs. Oh, he was phenomenal. He really led the team. For a little while, it looked like they might get upset at Stetson, but Preston Tucker came away with a big home run. Finally, I built him up early. I'm still confident he's going to be great. He finally got a home run on the board. But then the next day, they kind of came back to earth, I guess, or don't know what they were doing because they came back home, played FAU. They got a great start out of another freshman, Anthony Descalfani. He didn't give up a hit for the first 5 innings. Then in the 6th inning, things started falling apart. He hit the first batter, walked the next one, gave up his first hit, which was just a swinging bunt where it was a miscommunication between him and the catcher, got on first. They decided to pull him with one out and bases loaded, bring in the bullpen, Tony Davis, and gives, you know, pass ball, wild pitch, back-to-back, lets up 2 runs, walks the batter, gets pulled, Billy Bullock's in, doesn't do any better, lets up another 3 runs, and FAU takes the lead, and from there the Gators can never really, you know, recover from that. So they lost 7-6 to FAU, and Preston Tucker had a chance to win it late in the game, 2 outs, 2 runners on in the 9th, and he grounded out to end the inning. So he couldn't come through, but I'm still positive he'll eventually hit a game winner.
Those outs are always tough. But if we were going to mention Preston Tucker's greatness at this point, where would you place it?
At this, I'm not going to give him a greatness level at
this
point.
He's played 10.
I'm kidding.
Because
he's behind Mike Mooney, I would say.
He's definitely ahead of Mike Mooney.
I disagree. Mike Mooney plays in the field.
So is Preston Tucker. Almost every other game, he's actually at first base.
Almost every other game.
Has he surpassed Matt LaPorta at this point? Or not quite yet.
He's almost at Matt LaPorta's level, but Matt LaPorta, I guess, hit a couple more home runs already.
All right, so back to Arthur. It was the bullpen that completely blew that game, right, Kyle?
Yeah, the bullpen really let them down. I mean, DeSclafani had a great start, then he got into some trouble, and they put in Tony Davis, who's a junior, one of their kind of go-to guys in the bullpen. I mean, he lets all 3 inherited runners score, and then he gives up another couple runs on his own. So it was really just unimpressive. Wild pitch, the pass ball. Billy Bullock balked in a run that inning as well. So it was just a terrible performance by 2 of their go-to guys in the bullpen, which then led them to bring in Patrick Keating to finish the game the last 3 innings. He pitched pretty well in relief, but he let up 1 run that ended up being the decisive run and took a loss in a 7-6 decision.
All right, but Bullock, Davis, and even Keating, these are veterans. I mean, the freshmen are playing fairly well, right? It's just the veterans.
No, it's a mix. I mean, you've had situations where, you know, Nick Morande comes out on Sunday against Miami, gets shelled, can't throw a strike, you know. And so they've had mixed results from their freshmen. Some of the freshmen have come in relief and not done so hot. So I wouldn't say that it's been like the veterans are letting the freshmen down necessarily. It was in this game. But I wouldn't say that's necessarily the epidemic that's been going on this season.
I know it's still, like, super early. Like, you know, they had the great series to open the year against Louisville, got swept by Miami, pretty disappointing, lost to FAU. A few weeks ago, before the season started, we all gave our predictions on where we thought they'd end up to make the tournament and whatnot. Has anyone seen anything that makes them change their mind from what they said earlier?
I still see great potential in this team. I'm surprised that the sweep at Miami, I really thought they should have won at least Saturday's game. Friday, they had a chance to win it. I mean, you're not going to expect Keating to pitch that poorly again.
But you had him getting into a super regional.
I'm still going to stick behind that one.
Yeah. See, there's no way that's happening.
Yeah, I think that's way too much. But I'm not backing off of them getting in. I said they'd get into the NCAA tournament, be fairly competitive in a regional. I think that can still happen.
If you think they can get to a regional, they can get to a super regional. I mean, it's not that easy, but
it's way harder.
But if you can get into a regional, you're one of four teams trying to get into a super regional, correct?
Right.
Yeah, that's not that difficult.
It's a good competition.
Right. But you only have to win a couple games. I mean, it could happen. Like,
yeah,
the ball
sure.
Bounce.
They could
right.
win the whole thing. You just said, what have you seen so far, and does that affect, you know, your projections? I'd say if you're projecting them to go to a super regional, you should be fairly, you know, impressed with what they've done so far now. If that's where you're projecting them, we're not just saying they have an outside shot of getting there.
You mean you should be unimpressed by what they've done so far?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly.
Yeah, they've been far below.
The top 16 right. teams in the country go to the Super Regionals. I don't think they're one of the top 16 teams in the country
right,
at this point.
I mean, some Miami players said that. They said that we're trying to get into that top 8 so we can go to Omaha. No, you're trying to get into the top 64 and then win some games.
Okay, but we're talking about two
Miami
different things here, because we're talking about where we're projecting them to go, where we think they will likely end up, not what could possibly maybe happen in a 10% shot, because they could win the whole thing. Who knows? But that doesn't mean that they will. It's like the basketball team. They could win the SEC tournament. None of us think that they will.
I feel as though Patrick Keating, he did have that bad outing against Miami, but he is a solid pitcher. He is one of the better ones in the country. Alex Panathiotis, I think, is fantastic. And that's all they really need is those two guys to give them good outings. And one of the biggest problems so far this season has been that they just can't seem to hit with runners on. They just, I don't know what it is, they just seem to get scared when people are on base. And I think that comes around eventually. You're going to start getting the big hits from Dendek or Josh Adams, McArthur. You're going to get those guys to get the big hits, and the runs are going to start coming in. Because most of the team does have pretty good averages, especially early on. They just, in the front half of the lineup, they just can't seem to put hits together, which is a problem I think just will eventually come.
I think a lot of their mistakes have come so far from lack of intensity, really, because if you look, they've made a ton of errors. In this last, they lost four of their last five. They made 12 errors over that stretch. They've been poor in the field. The pitchers have had stretches where they can't throw the ball over the plate, and the hitters have had stretches where they just can't string hits together, kind of like living up to the moment. So I think the reason Keating's so important to this team is, like, yeah, Miami, he got beat. He gave up the lead a couple times, but they beat him. You know, he made them beat him. They gave up a couple home runs. It wasn't great. But you could see how hurt he was after that game, too. And he's such an intense guy, and he's such a great competitor. They need the whole team to take on his attitude if they're going to play well, because it's not just enough to be talented and show up every day. You have to come out expecting to win and being hurt when you don't. And that's kind of – he's kind of the only one who I've seen that out of, maybe McArthur a little bit, too, so far.
Yeah, I mean, Keating, it wasn't a very promising start, but, I mean, he really only made two bad pitches to the number 9 hitter in the lineup, and that was, what, 5 runs right there? I mean,
right.
He did pretty well against the rest of the lineup. Miami's a good team.
And then his other loss was the relief appearance yesterday, and he really didn't play – he really didn't pitch bad at all.
All right, so what can they change, like, I mean, in the lineup, other than just, change of attitude, which is hard to just implement immediately? I mean, what can they change?
I mean, I think the lineup is pretty close to – you know, once Pisani finally gets out of the lineup for good, they found the lineup that they're gonna they like. It's just a matter of finding where in the lineup these guys are going to, be most comfortable to put together hits. Because I mean, the guys, everyone in this lineup can hit. It's just whether or not they're gonna hit, behind someone else.
I got a couple things. Cooper needs to get out of the 8 hole.
Riley Cooper has been their best hitter so far this season. He's hit for power. He's fast on the base paths. He's hit for average. He shows up every day at the plate. And he has been their best hitter. And he hit eighth yesterday. Why? I cannot for the life of me understand. He's too many tools to hit eighth. He could be your three-hole hitter the way he's playing.
Walks?
I don't know. I mean, he's not the most patient hitter, but I don't think it's like necessarily detrimental. If he's going to hit 350, you know, he can with a 400 OBP. That's not great, but it's better than, you know, a lot of the guys are going to do. The other thing is Preston Tucker needs to be in the lineup every day. If it's a left-handed starting pitcher, I understand that a little bit more. But it seems like on days where he doesn't play, Jericho Weitzel plays, who's also a left-handed hitter, so that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I think he gives you a little, like, that fear factor in the lineup a little bit too. And Den Dekker has to be better. I know he hit a home run the other day against FAU, finally kind of got off the schneid, but he's hitting under 300. He's been very disappointing. And previous to the season, O'Sullivan said, he has to be good for us to have a good year, and he hasn't so far.
Bobby, when you said when Clayton Pisani gets out of lineup, would you rather have Jericho Weitzel in there?
No. What I want to happen is I want Preston Tucker to be the first baseman every day. MacArthur, he's a third baseman. He's played third base his whole life except last year. Last year was the first time he's ever played first. Move him over to third. Adams has played second in the past. Move him to second base where O'Sullivan has said over and over he can play anywhere on the field. Put him at second base. And Daniel Piggott has shown he can hit, and so has Tyler Thompson. He showed that he can hit. Put them as the DH, or if you want, throw him into the outfield and let, you know, Riley Cooper DH. Either way, it's going to be a better lineup than with Clayton Pisani hitting, you know, 200 on if he's like, I think right now he's at 208.
Or Weitzel. I mean, either one.
Weitzel, I've seen, I guess they like his bat and his heart. He's got a great work ethic. But, you know, I've seen him play defense. I'm not a fan of his defense.
I agree with Bobby. That's absolutely the best lineup. And Jericho Weitzel playing defense was funny because when he came out for one of the games, McCall was in the press box for the Miami series. And previous to the game, I saw him getting his first start at second base. And I said, he's going to make an error today, I guarantee you. And third hitter, first inning, he absolutely Chuck Knobloch's one. Just, like, throws it as wild as you can throw it to first base and came up with his first error. So the other thing I think that's big for them, they need to pick a catcher. Their pitching staff is really struggling here. You need a guy who can be a stabilizing force behind the plate. Right now they're playing, like, you know, this merry-go-round catching spot where you got Buddy Monroe some days, you got Hampton Tigner some days, Ben McMahon and Teddy Foster have seen some time. Pick an everyday catcher. I mean, he's going to have to get off days. That's the nature of the position. But pick somebody who's going to be your guy, who handles the pitching staff well, who's a calming influence, who does well with communication, and he needs to be your catcher and be that stabilizing infield force.
I don't know what he's got to choose something to sacrifice, I feel, because I think each one offers something. He seems to really like Buddy Monroe, but we've both noticed that Buddy Monroe isn't always the greatest defensive catcher. So I think he sometimes wants to put in some better defensively, especially with such young pitchers. But he against FAU, the most curious part of the game was Hampton Tigner started. He pinch run for Hampton Tigner. The next batter, Buddy Monroe pinch hit. And then since Hampton Tigner was out of the game, instead of just keeping Buddy Monroe in the game and letting him catch, Teddy Foster came in to catch. And someone came in for Buddy Monroe, and then someone pinched it for Teddy Foster. So had they actually tied the game, that he would have effectively used all four catchers in one game, which I would have been really impressed with.
Yeah, the switches were curious. And to wrap this up, they played Duquesne in a three-game series this weekend.
Confidence builder.
Duquesne comes in 0-8 in the out of the A-10 conference. They look pretty shoddy at best. And Keating, because he made his relief appearance in yesterday's game, he's getting pushed back in the rotation, so he's going to start Sunday's game instead of his normal Friday night spot. Pantaleotis is going to pitch Friday. Marunde slides up, and he's going to pitch on Saturday. So that's what the rotation looks like this weekend.
All right, I think that about wraps it up. Send any feedback to sports@alligator.org. Or, you know, if you like what you've been listening to, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us a review. We can get some positive reviews on iTunes. Spread the word a little bit. What was that?
Or negative, whatever you feel.
Yeah, or negative. I mean, if you want to tell us that this is the worst thing you've ever listened to, if you're still listening after 58 minutes and 53 seconds, please do. All right, Evan, go ahead and talk about the Red Wings so we can get this thing over with.
Last night they beat the Avalanche 3-2 to take first place in the entire National Hockey League. And, yeah, they're looking good.
Did Hossa get hurt?
Hossa, yes.
Watch hockey,
This is troubling because he was carted off the ice Tuesday night on a stretcher. But He's okay. He has a little bit of a knee injury. His knee is actually worse than his neck right now, but he should be playing by next week.
How do you slide into the boards head first and come up with a knee injury? That's impressive.
The knee injury was actually lingering.
Oh, okay.
Thoughts on the NHL trade deadline? Did the Red Wings get better?
I think that about wraps it up. The big winner with the Calgary Flames picked up Olli Jokinen from the Coyotes.
I just want to point out, we actually just had an NHL discussion there. I feel like this is a first and maybe a last.
Hopefully a last.
All right, so keep listening, and with that, we're out.